Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. Anaphylaxis to a specific food, environmental factor, or even a medication can be a serious healthcare concern, and it can also be debilitating in regards to our patient's quality of life. While avoiding the causative agent is ideal, pharmacologic options for anaphylaxis prevention continue to evolve, giving patients more options to live a life without fear. Dr. Jamie Reed, a former pharmacist at Mayo Clinic, will provide an evidence-based review of prevention and treatment of anaphylactic reactions to assist the general clinician when faced with this dilemma.
As some of you may know, that I enjoy traveling, and so on one of my recent flights, as I boarded the airplane and sat down in my seat, one of the flight attendants came over the intercom and announced that there's a passenger on board that has a severe peanut allergies, and so no peanut products will be served on the airplane today, and to refrain from eating any peanut products. Peanuts are honestly my favorite snack on flights, and so I was a little disappointed. But at the same time, then I started to think about that passenger, of how severe of an allergy they must have that it affects not only them, but everyone around them. And so that inspired my talk today that I'd like to share with you regarding anaphylaxis. So today, hopefully by the end of the presentation, you'll be able to recall the pathophysiology of anaphylaxis. We'll talk about how medicine can possibly prevent anaphylaxis and the occasion that it does occur, how we manage anaphylaxis. Anaphylaxis has been documented for hundreds of years, but was first defined in the early 1900s with ana meaning absence and phylaxis meaning protection, so the absence of protection. Although that it may not be common for us to see, it is relevant in our practice, and a physician here at Mayo, actually, Dr. Lee, who's an emergency department physician, utilized the Rochester Epidemiology Project to look at the incidence of anaphylaxis from 2001 to 2010 and found there's an estimated incidence of 42 per 100,000 person years, with an increasing incidence of up to 4.3% in this time frame. There is concern that anaphylaxis may be underdiagnosed, and so these numbers may be slightly lower than the actual incidence. Anaphylaxis may be caused from a multitude of things, including medications, environmental factors such as pollen, animal dander, dust mites, and also venoms from bees and wasps, also from radio contrast dyes, latex, and idiopathic causes. Dr. Lee also noted the most common anaphylaxis types per age groups and found that patients age 0 to 9 most commonly had food-related anaphylaxis, 20 to 39 years venom-related, so bees, wasp venom, and 30 to 39 years of age medication-related. Although anaphylaxis can occur related to any cause at any age. Anaphylaxis is a type of hypersensitivity reaction. There are four different types that are mainly differentiated by immune involvement. For the purpose of this talk, I will not be going into further detail of hypersensitivity reactions, but would like to highlight type 1 as that encompasses anaphylaxis. Type 1 hypersensitivity reactions are immediate IgE-mediated reactions. Unfortunately, the mechanism of anaphylaxis is not as simple. Upon first exposure to an allergen, a dendritic cell or antigen-presenting cell will uptake that allergen and present it to an immature T cell. The immature T cell will then present the allergen to a T helper 2 cell, which will stimulate production of inflammatory cytokines, including interleukin 4, 5, 9, and 13, to stimulate production of eosinophil, mucus production, and mature B cells to produce IgE-specific antibodies to that allergen. Upon second exposure, those IgE will bind to the surface of mast cells and basophils, and upon exposure to the allergen, will cause an intracellular release of contents of the mast cell and basophil. The intracellular contents are not well understood or defined, but believed to increase release of histamine, tryptase, bradykinin, prostaglandins, and platelet activating factor. These different mediators can help us explain and better understand the signs and symptoms associated with anaphylaxis. Anaphylaxis involves multiple different organ systems. Primarily, What we see is respiratory symptoms such as rhinorrhea, sneezing, angioedema. Additionally, cough, wheeze, and hypoxia. Cardiovascularly, signs and symptoms include hypotension, tachycardia, and syncope. Especially with involvement in the gastrointestinal tract, we can see nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. And also on the skin, we can see flushing, urticaria, and angioedema. The signs and symptoms of anaphylaxis help us with diagnosis criteria of anaphylaxis. The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and the Food Allergy and Anaphylaxis Network have determined diagnostic criteria for anaphylaxis, with anaphylaxis being highly likely if one of three major criteria are met. Major criteria are best differentiated by the presence of a known allergen or no known allergen. If no known allergen is present, there must be acute onset with skin and or mucosal tissue, plus either respiratory compromise or decrease in blood pressure or symptoms of end organ dysfunction. In the setting of a likely allergen to be involved, there must be two of the following: of involvement of skin mucosal tissue, respiratory compromise, decrease in blood pressure, or persistent gastrointestinal symptoms. In the setting of a known allergen, there must simply be reduced blood pressure involved based on age cutoffs. It's important to understand the diagnosis, but also to remember the mechanism of anaphylaxis. And so, which of the following mechanisms describes an anaphylactic reaction? You can utilize your cell phones at this time to text in your answers or poll ev.com/mayorrx online. I agree with the majority, or with everyone, that IgE-mediated antibodies bind to mast cells and basophils. The other answers are incorrect, as the mechanism does not include IgG and IgM antibodies. It's important to understand the mechanism to understand the best strategies for long-term management and prevention of anaphylaxis. Long-term management goal is to prevent severe life-threatening reactions through multitudes of options, including avoidance if possible, education and preparedness in case it does occur, and also desensitization. Desensitization can occur through immunotherapy, medication desensitization, and pre-medications. Overall, looking at a timeline, anaphylaxis was first defined in 1902, and early after, immunotherapy began to be studied, including oral immunotherapy, subsequently subcutaneous, sublingual, and then in the 1940s, medication desensitization, and then today. And so although these are not new strategies, they believe to be underutilized related to documented efficacy, documented cost effectiveness, the availability of resources, and the lack of awareness that these options are available. The different types of desensitization have different allergy targets that can be seen and used. And so immunotherapy targets food and environmental allergies. Food allergies commonly of milk, eggs, and peanuts or nut products, and environmental allergies including pollen, dust mites, cat and animal danders, and also including venoms such as wasps and bees. Medication desensitization, as in its name, is related to medications, for example, antibiotics and aspirin, and pre-medications include most commonly contrast. Looking at the different immunotherapy types, there are different types and also different targets, and so some immunotherapies have single versus multiple allergen targets. To differentiate the types, we look at the routes of administration, and so there's subcutaneous, sublingual, and oral. Currently, there's no documented efficacy of one route or type being superior to a different route. The duration of immunotherapy is about 3 years, but can range from 2 to 5 years, and they've seen potential benefit even after discontinuation. To compare the different types based on allergy targets and dosing, subcutaneous has been studied for environmental and Hymenoptera venoms, such as bees and wasps, with a typical dosing of weekly for 6 months, followed by every 4 to 8 week intervals at a clinic. So subcutaneous immunotherapy must be administered at a clinic. Compared to sublingual, sublingual current targets include environmental and food targets, with daily administration with the first dose in the clinic to ensure tolerability. Oral is currently only studied in food allergy targets, with a daily first dose in the clinic with subsequent daily dosing after. Overall, dosing for all immunotherapies starts with a very low dose of that allergen that's up-titrated over time as tolerated to a maintenance suppression dose for that allergy. The mechanism is very interesting and unique, So upon administration of immunotherapy, those allergens are taken up by a dendritic cell and stimulate T regulatory cells to induce interleukin-10 and tissue growth factor beta, which are non-inflammatory cytokines. These non-inflammatory cytokines suppress T helper 2 activation, so suppressing eosinophil production, mucus production, and most importantly, IgE-produced antibodies. The allergen also can play a role on T regulatory 1 cells to release interleukin-10, again a non-inflammatory cytokine, to act on mature B cells and produce IgG4 antibodies. IgG4 antibodies are actually non-inflammatory and can bind and inactivate circulating IgE. With this really unique and exciting mechanism comes excitement and new drug products and drug therapies. And so AR101 is something recently studied in the Palisade trial for peanut allergy oral immunotherapy study for desensitization. And AR101 is an oral peanut-derived biologic drug. It is sourced from raw peanuts that contains 50% peanut protein, with capsules varying doses starting at 0.5 milligrams or 1/400th of a peanut to up to 300 milligrams of peanut protein or about 1.5 peanuts, with the goal of 300 milligrams daily dosing. AR101 was studied in a phase 3 prospective multicenter randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial, which is currently one of the largest immunotherapy trials to date, that included 551 patients randomized 3-to-1 to the treatment group compared to placebo. The primary endpoint of this study was the ability to ingest a single dose of at least 600 milligrams of peanut protein, or about 3 peanuts, with no dose-limiting symptoms, such as mild symptoms that required no intervention or no symptoms at all. The protocol started with an initial phase that was administered at the clinic to ensure tolerability and up-titrated, and then once determined that they were able to tolerate the drug, was up-dosing over 6 months with increases every 2 weeks to maximum tolerated doses. The maximum tolerated dose would then be continued for a total duration of therapy of 12 months. At the end of therapy, there was an exit food challenge that was double-blind placebo-controlled, where patients were to consume in dose increments as tolerated 300 milligrams peanut protein up to 1,000 milligrams peanut protein. So 1,000 milligrams is equivalent to about 5 peanuts, with remembering the goal that the primary outcome was that patients were able to tolerate 600 milligrams of peanut protein, or about 3 peanuts. The results, as seen in this chart, specifically for ages 4 to 17, with the y-axis being participants tolerated the regimen in percentage and the x-axis of doses of peanut protein ingested, and pink being the treatment group of AR101, we see that the 600 milligrams, that patients in the treatment group were able to tolerate that at 67% versus 4%, which is very significant and exciting for this drug. Overall, though, you can also see that even 50% of patients were able to tolerate up to 1,000 milligram dose without dose-limiting effects. We may be concerned, as this is an allergy medication and immunotherapy, about systemic allergic reactions that may have occurred during the study. Looking at the percentage of reactions based on severity of reactions, with mild requiring no intervention, moderate requiring intervention, and severe requiring intervention such as hospitalization, we see that only 0.3% of patients in the treatment group required or had a severe allergic reaction. Otherwise, majority were moderate or mild. Also, something to consider is the epinephrine utilization between the two groups. And so in the maintenance phase, epinephrine was 14% compared to 6.5% in placebo. With a noted location administration, more often epinephrine was utilized at home versus in the clinic. And interestingly, that epinephrine was more often used in placebo versus AR1 at home. So 88% of patients in placebo utilized epinephrine at home versus 67% in AR101. Also, looking at the exit food challenge of how many patients required epinephrine, placebo required, or 53% of the placebo group utilized epinephrine compared to 10% of the AR101 or treatment trial. That can also be a sign that AR101 was effective at developing tolerance to the peanut product, so a positive marker. Overall, AR101 appears safe and effective at desensitizing patients specifically 4 to 17 years of age with peanut allergies. And importantly to note that this is prevention of anaphylaxis from incidental ingestions. The purpose of this immunotherapy is not to allow patients then to be able to consume peanuts, but to prevent anaphylaxis if it does occur. Further studies are warranted for long-term efficacy and safety, as this is a phase 3 trial, so FDA approval would need to be completed prior to this being offered to patients, but also that this was 12 months in duration, and most immunotherapy regimens are 2 to 5 years of therapy. There are still some concerns that patients may have allergic reactions or epinephrine, but I believe that the benefit outweighs the risk with this current evidence. Other additional immunotherapy questions to answer overall was which formulation is most effective? Is oral most effective for food allergies or perhaps sublingual, as it has been studied also in food allergies? What's the best method for patients with multiple allergies, as most patients that do have one allergy often have additional? The optimal duration of therapy is 3 to 5 years sufficient. The use for primary and secondary prevention, does an initial anaphylaxis event have to occur prior to using or recommending immunotherapy? And what is the cost effectiveness? As of course, AR101 is a new biologic drug, and especially with new drugs and biologic drugs, we often know that that's a high-cost drug when it comes to market. And so what is the cost effectiveness of this drug going to be? Transitioning from immunotherapy and environmental allergies and food allergies, we can talk next about medication allergies. Medication allergies are estimated 1 case in 4,000 emergency department visits and can cause up to 58% fatality. Most common drugs include non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, beta-lactams, and radiocontrast media. Management strategies for these medication allergies to prevent them include medication desensitization and pre-medication. Medication desensitization has a goal to induce tolerance without adverse effect. It is done by rapid titration of a diluted drug to full concentration and can be completed in multiple different routes, including oral, intramuscular, and intravenous. Most common drugs that we perform medication desensitization in includes antibiotics and aspirin. This, though, requires monitoring and diligent administration of subsequent doses for success. So this is something that must be done under clinical supervision. Pearls for medication desensitization include no premedication. So although this may be counterintuitive, we do not recommend using premedication prior to this, as we'd like to see any reactions that may occur at even with the starting dose. In patients with a severe reaction history, we can start with a very dilute product to start and up titrate as able. Adverse reactions that may occur during desensitization, it's recommended to stop the titration and resume it at the last tolerated dose. If a severe reaction occurs requiring additional escalation of care, then potentially discontinuing the medication desensitization protocol would be likely the best option. Then always a question of tolerance duration. And so it's thought that tolerance remains for up to 4 to 5 contextual half-lives of the drug. And so if more than 4 or 5 half-lives pass, the patient is deemed intolerant and medication desensitization would have to restart if we'd like to continue that medication. Moving from medication desensitization to pre-medication strategies, pre-medication is commonly utilized for contrast allergies. Contrast allergies are documented in up to 3% of patients, and in patients that have had an initial event are 3 to 4 times higher risk of having a re-event. Important to note that pre-medication reduces but does not eliminate the risk of anaphylaxis. Two important studies that have looked at contrast or pre-medication and contrast include Lasser and colleagues and Greenberger and colleagues. Although they may be dated, they're still very applicable to our practice. In 1987, Lasser and colleagues did a prospective multicenter randomized trial that looked at about 7,000 patients with a history of previous anaphylaxis with contrast. They compared 3 different regimens, utilizing methylprednisolone 32 milligrams orally and a 2-dose series, a 1-dose, or placebo. The contrast that they used was conventional and steroids in the steroid groups and non-ionic or lower osmolality in the placebo group. The primary outcome was immediate reactions after the giving contrast and found that there were less reactions in the 2-dose steroid group compared to the 1-dose and placebo of a comparison of 6.4% and the 2-dose compared to 9% in the 1-dose and placebo. Overall, it proves that there is a reduction in reactions with the use of methylprednisolone or steroids, especially a further reduction with the use of two doses of steroids versus one. Greenberger and colleagues then, in 1991, did a prospective observational study looking at 146 patients, again with a history of previous anaphylaxis with contrast, and utilized a slightly different intervention. It was prednisone 50 milligrams every 6 hours for three doses with the addition of Benadryl, a one-time dose. And they did compare this regimen in IV contrast groups of conventional versus non-ionic or lower osmolality, and looking again at the immediate generalized reactions after giving contrast, and found that in the conventional IV contrast group, 10% had a reaction versus lower osmolality or non-ionic, 0.7%. So again, of expecting that majority or almost all of these patients might have a reaction with contrast, that there was a significant reduction in reaction or immediate generalized reactions, and even further reduction in patients that received lower osmolality contrast. In conclusion, premedication prior to contrast is effective to reduce anaphylactic reactions with a history of in patients with a history of anaphylaxis. Although it may not completely eliminate the risk, it is significantly reduced in patients that do need to have contrast. Ask Mayo Expert also utilizes these studies for their recommendations, and they make recommendations based on the severity of previous reaction. So in mild to moderate, they recommend the methylprednisolone 32 milligram dose for two doses at 12 and 2 hours prior to procedure, with a plus or minus of additional Benadryl or diphenhydramine 50 milligrams, IV, intramuscular, or orally prior to procedure. Another option would be from Greenberger and colleagues with of prednisone 50 milligrams orally at 13, 7, and 1 hour prior to procedure, plus Benadryl or diphenhydramine 50 milligrams, again, either intravenous, intramuscular, or oral, 1 hour prior to procedure. For patients that have a severe previous reaction, it's recommended that you contact radiology to discuss contrast options and pretreatment options to further optimize the reduction of another anaphylaxis reaction. Let's sum up our desensitization. So which of the following methods of desensitization would be most appropriate for a patient with a history of anaphylaxis to a food product such as peanuts? I agree with the majority that oral immunotherapy is currently studied for the use of food products, specifically peanuts. Subcutaneous immunotherapy has currently only been studied in environmental and venom allergens. Medication desensitization and premedications are only utilized for medications allergies. Transitioning now, if a patient does have anaphylaxis or it does occur, especially outpatient, the World Allergy Organization and American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology recommend administering epinephrine as first-line therapy, followed by calling 911. Acute management overall includes administration of epinephrine with additional doses needed can be administered after the first dose. Protection of airway should be a priority as well, stopping the causative agent if known, and then administering supportive medications. These supportive medications are considered second-line agents, but are also very important in the overall management. Fluids can be used to help blood pressure control. Oxygen can help if patients are experiencing hypoxemia. Inhaled beta agonists can help with treating bronchospasms, such as nebulized albuterol. Steroids can help prevent recurrent anaphylaxis. Biphasic anaphylaxis can occur in up to 20% of patients, and biphasic anaphylaxis is the occurrence of an anaphylaxis episode up to 12 to 24 hours after the first. And so utilization of steroids is very important to prevent this, and methylprednisolone, dexamethasone, and prednisone are options for steroids. Antihistamines can reduce histamine, and so Commonly, we utilize Benadryl or Famotidine as options for antihistamine agents. To further discuss epinephrine, it is the only medication that currently has mortality benefits in patients with anaphylaxis. The strength is 1 to 1,000 or 1 milligram per ml. Considering in a code situation, we would utilize the vial instead of the syringes if you're in that scenario. With typical dosing for children, 0.01 milligram per kilogram intramuscularly with a max of 0.3 to 0.5 milligrams, with 0.5 milligrams really being reserved for healthcare professional administration. Adult dosing includes 0.2 to 0.5 milligrams intramuscularly. Additional doses may be repeated 5 to 15 minutes after the first dose if symptoms are not improving or worsening. There are no contraindications to epinephrine as it is considered a life-saving treatment, so the benefit outweighs the risk. And of course, the cost of epinephrine is relatively expensive for patients. And so general costs for a two-pack, which is a typical pack for epinephrine, is about $118. And for the 0.15 milligram pens or the Epi Junior pens is about $150. It's important to note too that the two pens are not to benefit that one can be in the car and one can be at home or one can be at school, that they should be kept together so that in case you need to utilize the second pen, you have both of them together. There is currently a shortage, but it is highly recommended that all patients have non-expired epinephrine at home available to use if they do have a history of anaphylaxis. With that, let's apply this to a case. So Jane is a 14-year-old girl who presents to the emergency department with hives, shortness of breath, and nausea after a birthday party at a friend's house. There are no known drug allergies or allergies in general, and vitals are respiratory rate is elevated, heart rate is elevated, and blood pressure is within normal limit. Which of the following symptoms would indicate that Jane has experienced anaphylaxis? I agree with majority that all of the above is the correct answer. Hives are a skin reaction. Shortness of breath is a respiratory compromise reaction. And nausea is a gastrointestinal reaction that is included as a symptom or a sign of anaphylaxis. Prior to the emergency physician seeing Jane, she becomes nauseous and starts vomiting. What is the recommended acute treatment for Jane? I agree. Epinephrine is the first choice as this is a worsening or a sign of anaphylaxis. And so if epinephrine was not already administered, it'd even be recommended to administer again as symptoms are worsening or progressing. Zofran, diphenhydramine, and prochlorperazine are antiemetics and would help with nausea, but are not recommended as this is an anaphylactic reaction. It is determined that Jane had an allergic reaction from an unknown food she ate at the party, which was resolved after you recommended giving epinephrine. You hear Jane is ready for discharge, and you review her discharge medication list and notice no epinephrine is prescribed. What would you do? A, contact the team to prescribe epinephrine, or B, leave the discharge list as is, as she does not require epinephrine at home. I agree. Contact the team to prescribe epinephrine, as she did have an allergic reaction, anaphylactic reaction. Although we do not know exactly what it was from, we should still provide prevention in case it does occur additionally and offer follow-up to an allergy specialist or someone so that she can better identify what the cause was. To summarize, anaphylaxis reactions are complex IgE-mediated reactions to allergens. Immunotherapy shows significant improvement for prevention of anaphylaxis to food and environmental allergies, although further evidence is needed to assist with long-term prevention strategies. And epinephrine is the first-line treatment for anaphylaxis reactions, but it's also important to remember those adjunct strategies to help manage the anaphylaxis reaction and prevent an additional reaction to occur. With that, I will answer any questions.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.